This week, the National Association of Asian American Professionals is holding its annual leadership conference in Kansas City. And the keynote speaker is kind of an unconventional choice. His name is Simon Tam, and he's the frontman of a band called The Slants. If you were paying attention to the news a few years back, you may recall that this very band name landed Simon Tam in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, placing him at the center of this question: should you be able to trademark a racial slur? I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and Simon Tam has just published a memoir letting all of us into the personal story behind his moment in the national spotlight. Simon Tam, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for being with me. So for those who are either too young to have followed the story at the time or who just maybe don't remember the details, can you quickly recap the story of how calling your band The Slants took you to the Supreme Court? Just a
sure.
little story, that little one.
Just a little one. Something that will condense like 8 years of my life into a minute.
Yeah, let's just do that.
Well, basically what happened is we had been a band for a couple of years and decided to register our name as a trademark, something very standard for bands to do. But the U.S. government, more particularly the trademark office, said no, that we couldn't, because they said our name was disparaging to persons of Asian descent, even though we were an all-Asian band. And eventually we found out that the reason why they associated our name with this kind of outdated and obscure racial slur is because they precisely said we were Asian. They said, well, if you weren't Asian, essentially this wouldn't be a problem. But because you're Asian, people are going to associate the name with the slur, so you can't use it.
So why did you call your band The Slants? I want to back up at some point and get the rest of that story, but I think that's important to get to at this stage.
Sure. So I wanted to call our band The Slants because I wanted to speak about our perspective, or our slant on life, if you will, of what it's like to be people of color, but also while kind of flipping this stereotype on its head, because the idea of having slanted eyes, it isn't really true. Like, not all Asian people have slanted eyes, and we're not the only people on the planet with slanted eyes. So I thought, what if we used our name as a way to kind of drive this conversation and make people think more deeply about racial issues?
Do you think of that stereotype as somehow being something that has affected you in the course of your life?
Well, growing up, yeah. I mean, I was violently attacked multiple times. I was bullied relentlessly for having these facial features, for having the kind of hair that I had. And so certainly when I was growing up, I felt a profound sense of shame associated with these eyes. And because I knew Asians are actually the most bullied demographic in the K-12 system, that I wasn't alone. So when I was deciding to start a band, I thought, you know, what if we associate it with self-empowerment instead of shame? And that's kind of how the idea for the band and the band's name kind of came to be.
You grew up in Southern California and your parents had a restaurant. Can you tell me more about your upbringing, how that, where you were and the context you grew up in maybe affected your relationship with this whole topic?
Well, I grew up in San Diego, California, and I think a lot of people are surprised because they assume San Diego is a very diverse place, but this is in the early 80s, and, you know, we didn't have the kind of representation for Asian Americans that we do today. You know, I think we still have a ways to go, but, I mean, this is decades before Crazy Rich Asians or Fresh Off the Boat was on TV or anything like that. So the only things that people knew about Asian Americans came from a lot of unrest, like people being very upset about the rise of Japanese automobiles coming up. And so they just saw anyone that was like us as different, as exotic, as kind of not American, even though my family had actually had roots here since the mid-1800s. And so my parents had difficulty finding work wherever they went and decided, like many people in my family, to start their own business. And of course, my dad's a great chef, opened a restaurant. And so I spent a lot of time in that restaurant because they couldn't get a babysitter. And so at the age of like 7, I was waiting tables and taking orders and helping them out.
Tell me about the food in your parents' restaurant.
It was primarily Cantonese food, but some kind of Sichuan influences. My dad's from the Canton region, so a lot of seafood. And of course, because it was a Chinese restaurant in America, we were kind of catering to American audiences as well. So you had your typical like broccoli, beef, sweet and sour pork, things like that you traditionally wouldn't find in China, like anywhere. Like broccoli is not a natural vegetable out there. But we wanted to cater to the audience as well, using kind of Chinese techniques and combining those with American ingredients. And, it, you know, that's kind of what ended up happening. So I ate Chinese food like all the time.
You know, you were, by virtue of working in this restaurant from a young age, that put you right at the intersection between, you know, where most people who are not Asian in America are like almost guaranteed to have a point of contact with Asian culture, which would be at a restaurant.
Absolutely. It was great. And what a fun way to like meet all kinds of people from all kinds of backgrounds and to share a piece of our culture with them. And I, because of that, I saw the profound effect and the power of sharing culture, which is why I knew that music could be something that could be universe, could kind of transcend these traditional barriers and divisions.
When did you fall in love with music? I mean, you fell in love with punk music. And I feel like as someone who has already sort of chronicled this journey as a bullied child, punk music doesn't come as a surprise to me.
Yeah, I actually fell in love with music. As long as I could remember. I mean, my parents have these home videos of me where I would take an acoustic guitar, jump up on the coffee table at age like 2 or 3 and pretend to play a show. Like I would just scream and hit this instrument. And so like I had some kind of connection with it, and I would fall asleep next to my dad's like hi-fi stereo playing records where, you know, he actually bought all these children's records for us, like Sesame Street and that kind of thing. But I was far more interested in the Rolling Stones and the Beatles. And my parents saw that. In fact, when I was in 3rd through 5th grade, they would actually pay me like $1 per song if I memorized and could sing back the lyrics of 50s and 60s songs to them.
You were a professional. You were getting paid.
Well, see, here's the thing. They said I was getting paid. Like they kind of told me I was getting paid to work at this restaurant. But then whenever I asked for said payment, they said, oh, we'll put it in your college fund. So that's kind of how that ended up.
Well, the parent-child payment systems can get kind of like that.
Very clever deferral system, yes.
So, but I do want to talk to you about then how all of this informs you at this moment where you're deciding to call your band The Slants. First of all, tell me about the band itself, the idea behind it, what you hope to do with it.
Well, the idea for the band kind of existed for a couple of years. And it mostly came out of just feeling isolated and lonely. I was living in Portland, Oregon, which a lot of people call America's whitest major city. And when I was there, I just felt like I was missing my culture, hearing my language, missing my food, seeing people that look like me. And so to kind of deal with that loneliness, I would actually import movies on eBay from Hong Kong. And around that time period, like someone's like, hey, you should check out this movie, Kill Bill. And when I remember watching it, there's a very iconic scene where a woman's walking into this sushi restaurant. And at that moment, I thought, wow, like that was actually the first time I had ever seen an American produced film that showed Asians as cool, confident, and sexy. Why hadn't I seen like that in the music world? You know, I mean, this is 2004, and up until that point, I didn't see any Asian Americans featured in Rolling Stone, Pitchfork, Spin, MTV. And this is despite the fact that there was like almost 18 million Asian Americans. And so that at that moment, I decided something needed to change. And because I was kind of starting to reconnect with my culture, my heritage again, I thought, why not start this band and provide this bold portrayal of our culture? You know, kind of that shared experience that we have, despite, you know, many of us in my band over the years have come from different Asian backgrounds, but we all share like a very unique experience in that we all kind of get treated as we're one and the same.
When you talk about this, the boldness of it, and that the name seems like part of that, sort of taking back this term that had been used in such a hurtful way for generations. There was this moment in American counterculture when appropriating slurs was a bigger thing. And I want to take listeners back to that a little bit because I feel like it's important. We're in such a different cultural moment now. I'm Jewish, and in the early 2000s, I was part of a scrappy little magazine called Hebe, the New Jew Review, and That felt totally empowering to me and just funny. But I do not think I would have the same confidence today putting that word out there, because I don't know that I'd have the same trust today in the good intentions of a general audience. Do you ever feel that way with the band name Slants, or do you still kind of live in that sensibility and like hold on to it?
I think I still believe in the power of reappropriation, and you know, to its credit, Heeb still exists. They're online. I know the editor very well. And so people are still using language and art in these innovative and different kinds of ways. At the very least, if it makes people's heads turn, we can have a conversation. We can talk about it and not just let it go. I also like to remind people that, you know, there would be no such thing as racial slurs, homophobic slurs, or anything like that if we didn't live in a society that actually has racism in it. And so we have to kind of create these moments of preparing people for thinking more deeply about these issues. And I think reappropriation is like a really, really cool way to do it, because it can be disarming. People can say, like, why is that funny? Why is that angering? And you can actually have an honest conversation about those experiences.
Well, you sure did have that conversation.
Well, reluctantly at a very national level. But, you know, even before then, I would play shows and we would have non-Asians come up to us and like, so why are you called the Slants? Almost like they were probing, like, because they're afraid to talk about it. And I was like, oh, are you saying it because I have slanted eyes? And all of a sudden, you know, we can actually talk about those experiences and why. And so it became like this really, really powerful tool for engaging with people and to share those aspects of my identity that might otherwise just been left alone, ignored, and allow these kind of stereotypes to remain in their minds.
So that seems like a good place to pick up the story of how you naming your band The Slants eventually led you to the Supreme Court. Can you pick that up where you left off?
Sure. So we're in the middle of applying for this trademark. Trademark office says, no, it's disparaging to persons of Asian descent. They were citing an old bit of law called the Lanham Act, written in the 1930s. And I was like really shocked, because first of all, I was like, there's all kinds of offensive stuff out there. I didn't even know that this law existed. And when I found out that the way they're supposed to use the law is that in order for them to justify denying a right to someone, they had to prove that what's called a substantial composite of that group was offended or disparaged by the name. And so in our case, I said, you know, hey, we've been touring for 2 years. We've been working with social justice groups across, you know, over 30 states doing anti-bullying programs. Who did they find who's actually offended? Turns out the government didn't find a single person. They were relying on an entry from UrbanDictionary.com, a wiki joke website.
Wow.
And so the kind of resource that wouldn't be accepted in a junior high classroom, that what was being used to deny me my rights.
So what'd you do?
Well, we fought back in the traditional way, which is kind of a weird thing to think about. Like, how do you prove you're not offensive to yourself? And in our case, we got executive directors of numerous social justice organizations that represented the Asian American community. We got academics. We got two independent national surveys. We got a linguistics expert from Duke University who wrote a huge paper on the history of the term slant and talking about how it had been actually reappropriated and the way we were using it was not offensive to our community. Essentially, thousands and thousands of Asian Americans stood up for us, backed our cause, and supported us through this very kind of legal process.
That's really touching, especially coming out of, you know, this period you had described in your life of feeling exceptionally isolated from your fellow Asian Americans living in Portland, which you've told us has been called the whitest city in America.
It was incredibly humbling. And I mean, there was so much momentum. I thought, this is unbelievable. It was actually the largest appeal in U.S. history for someone who had been denied for this kind of thing. But we sent all of this in, and a month later, the government said no. They said, your effort is laudable, but not influential. And they not only brought out UrbanDictionary.com again, they also relied on two white supremacist websites that they used the rhetoric from. and they charted out a dictionary from 1942, so not a contemporary dictionary, and it wasn't even an American dictionary. It was a British dictionary. And that's what they used to wipe away the voices of my community.
When you think back on this, are you surprised that you were able to keep going and eventually win this case?
I would say that felt like a really dark moment. It felt like, wow, they don't actually care what we think. Like, they're claiming they do. They're claiming they're trying to protect my community. But when we actually stood up and kind of brought this all these issues to the forefront and used a, you know, the resources that were required, the voices that were brought out, they never expected that to come out from, like, you know, a synth pop band from Portland, Oregon. So I think they were kind of surprised. But that's the system. Like, if you look at the history of Asian Americans in courts, we didn't stand a chance. We had to find a new way of tackling that issue.
We're going to get back to this story with Simon Tam, the author of Slanted, How an Asian American Troublemaker Took on the Supreme Court. We'll hear how that all turned out, plus what this week's Leadership Conference for Asian Americans being hosted in Kansas City means to him. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Stay with us. I'm Gina Kaufman, and my guest is Simon Tam, the author of Slanted, How an Asian American Troublemaker Took on the Supreme Court. He's also the keynote speaker for a national leadership conference in Kansas City this week, specifically geared toward Asian American professionals. Hi again, Simon.
Hey.
So you have been telling us the story of how naming your band The Slants took you to the Supreme Court. At the point where you are in the story, it's not looking so good for you and your cause. Can you talk to us about what turned it around?
Well, really just kind of a new idea. At the time that I got this massive rejection, despite our best efforts, my attorney actually said, you know, law is really hard. I'm going to not renew my license. So you're going to have to find someone else to help you out in this. I found an attorney named Ron Coleman who blogged about us and reached out to him, and he agreed to take the case up pro bono. But he said, as long as you fight like this, you're not going to win. We're going to need to try something else.
And fight so, like this meaning like what?
Basically saying you're not offensive to yourself and using this very traditional kind of method, like bringing in experts and kind of evidence from the Asian American community. And so he said, we got to try something else. He said, you know, slant means a lot of different things. What if we reapplied but didn't tell them that you were Asian? You know, he thought maybe we'll just get someone else, someone who didn't associate that with a racial slur, and they'll just rubber stamp the application through. Well, we reapplied, but the government gave us the exact same examining attorney who copied and pasted his previous response into that new application. And so, of course, I was extremely frustrated. I was like, you know, we just wasted 2 years of all that research, all that support. But my attorney, Ron, said, no, we got them. They just broke their own rules because apparently, according to the examining procedures manual, they have to do a fresh search every time a new application comes in. But it was obvious that they didn't do that because all of the evidence he used was predating my application by 2 years. And on top of that, they're supposed to do what's called like a neutral search, but it definitely wasn't neutral because the only time they ever found anything offensive in connection with the word slant was when they wrote slant plus the word derogatory plus the N-word in their search. And that was the only time. So we thought we can get on these kind of procedural and evidentiary issues. Turns out that wasn't effective either.
Okay. But what was? What? Because you won this case.
Yeah. So what ended up happening was right before we're going to the federal circuit, so right below the Supreme Court, Ron actually had a medical emergency. The junior associate attorney was doing most of the writing and research anyway, and he thought, you know, we're totally going to win using these technical arguments at the federal circuit, but just in case, I'm going to try out these other things. And so he decided to argue that maybe the law was unconstitutional because it violated my First Amendment rights, and maybe it also violated my Fifth Amendment rights because, you know, we asked the government, we said, wait, if slant is really this racial slur that you claim it is, how come you gave it to 800 other people? Why is it that everyone else has ever applied got it? And they said it was incontestable that I was of Asian descent and part of an Asian band. Therefore, it was associated with the racial slur. And it turns out we weren't the only ones. Like, if you look up any racial slur for an Asian American, every single one was a registered trademark. But whenever an Asian person applied, they were rejected. Same thing goes for any kind of reappropriated term from LGBTQ communities or other people of color. So it turns out that us, by reappropriating these words and symbols, it actually made us prime targets under this law. And no one was really paying attention because it was such kind of an obscure bit of law. So we brought all this forward to the federal circuit. And there, 9 out of 12 federal judges said, we agree with the ban. This law is unconstitutional under the First Amendment. And of course, the government doesn't take the cancellation of laws very lightly, so they dragged me to the Supreme Court, and I had to go through it all over again in 2017.
The case that you fought at the Supreme Court went in front of that court on some level instead of a case that a member of the Navajo Nation wanted to bring to challenge the Washington NFL team's patent on the term Redskins. Do you see what you are doing with your band name as being the same as what football teams like the one in Washington are doing with their team names and mascots, or is it on some fundamental level very different?
I would say ethically it's definitely different. But the law, like what's right and what's legal, isn't always like in a line. So for us, we were actually reappropriating a term that means a lot of different things, a term that for its most of its history in the English language meant something very different. It was actually white supremacists and racists that reappropriated slant and other words like it to make it, associated with something derogatory. Whereas the Washington football team, that term has always been racist. It's always been, rooted in violence and
it doesn't have a generalized
terror meaning. It doesn't, unless you're talking like potatoes or, like using it as an adjective. But when you refer to people, it's very, very specific. That being said, we understand that it's very difficult to write laws around intention when it comes to something like a trademark registration, because trademarks can be transferred. And the thing is, even if, say, the other case, which was Black Horse v. Pro Football, if they were successful in getting those trademarks canceled, the team still wouldn't be obligated to change its name. They would simply lose their trademark registration. They wouldn't even lose their trademark protection. So it was more of a symbolic victory more than anything else, which, obviously when I approached it, and I'm not a supporter of Dan Snyder and his choice for the football team name. And so obviously it was like pretty complex moving into this. I didn't want to accidentally empower the team name or the use of mascots. But at the same time, I saw what the law was doing. I saw how it was being used to target people by their sexual orientation and by their race. And I knew that couldn't stand. And that's when I kind of came to understand that, our ideas of justice, they have to be more than just about punishing people who take advantage of our laws. What we have to do is provide more options to those with the fewest options in our society. That's a more equitable process.
So just stepping back from this for a minute, you are here to speak on leadership for a national group of Asian American professionals. What does that mean to you? What do you think that your story teaches about leadership?
Well, I think for me, it's about learning to lean on your values, to clearly figure out what those are, and to figure out how the articulation of those values can appear no matter what you do and no matter what field you're in. The funny coincidence is that and the convention doesn't even know this even right now, but I actually studied leadership for many, many years. At the age of 13, I was given this book called Developing the Leader Within You by one of my mentors, and it completely radically changed me. I mean, I from that age, I decided I'm going to read at least 2 books on leadership every month for the rest of my life.
Holy
and so
moly.
I've actually built a leadership library. And this week, as part of this experience going to the conference, I was looking at this library and realized, I want to pay this forward. So I've announce on social media and my website that if someone was looking to develop their skills or understanding of leadership or communications in some area, I would choose a book for them, but depending on their industry or their values or what they're looking to do, and send it to them. And so I'm trying to like spread that idea. So it's kind of funny how it's all coming together this week in Kansas City, where I can talk about like, you know, the lessons I've learned, but use my story as a vehicle to do so and show like how even this, like, you know, me, the guy who dropped out of college to join a touring punk rock band, could literally change the laws of this country at the nation's highest court by holding firm to this idea of leadership and steadfast values.
What do you think? Do you think that there are leadership challenges or issues facing people who are trying to like reach that level in their careers if they are Asian American that maybe people outside your community wouldn't think about or consider?
Yeah, there's certainly challenges. We in our community, we kind of nickname it the bamboo ceiling. It's kind of obviously analogous to the glass ceiling that women face, where, you know, we're perceived as quiet, reserved, unassuming, and therefore not necessarily fit for executive leadership. And so anytime you're up against stereotypes or assumptions, it can be very, very tough because oftentimes you'll have to do more work than say someone else who might be given a different kind of consideration. That being said, I think that there are opportunities, and I think we're in a critical moment right now where people are starting to view my communities different. I mean, if you think about this, the very first time that an Asian person ever kissed a Caucasian woman in mainstream media was 2013. It was on The Walking Dead. Like, before that, it had never been seen before in movies or television. Like, we've come a long way in just the last few years, and I think the success of comedy and musicians and films are starting to change those perceptions. And when you change the culture and especially the arts, I think it has a profound impact, and even in our corporate workplaces as well. So we have a moment where people can seize these opportunities and understand them and actually present them and challenge them, push back a little bit. And that's why I think that the convention wanted me to speak, because I kind of have a very unconventional story, and their theme is unconventional leadership. So like for me, I call myself a bit of a troublemaker, a label that was given to me by the government that I've gladly taken on. And I'm hoping to say like, hey, it's okay to stir up some trouble from time to time. Hey, it's okay to lean on your values, to fight for the things you're passionate about, to effect greater change.
I like that you've reappropriated troublemaker too.
Yeah. So it's kind of my job title now.
Simon Tam, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Simon's keynote address for the National Association of Asian American Professionals in Kansas City is this Friday. We'll link to more information with the audio from today's show. Up next, how the question of stereotypes in pop culture plays out in naming not just bands, but also football teams, including possibly our football team. Stay with us. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. While our last guest, Simon Tam, was making his case for trademarking his band name, The Slants, another trademark case petitioned the Supreme Court to be considered as part of the decision. That was Pro Football Inc. versus Blackhorse. Amanda Blackhorse is a member of the Navajo Nation, and she wanted the U.S. Patent Office to cancel the Washington Redskins' patents based on the disparagement law, a law that slurs cannot be trademarked. It's a long, complicated story, but basically the Supreme Court looked at Simon's case instead of that one. But questions remain for pro football teams throughout the NFL, specifically for the Chiefs. While preseason ramps up, we want to revisit our conversation from last December about the Chiefs' name. Back then, we were discussing how, for the first time, the Chiefs didn't qualify for the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Sports Award. In fact, in an op-ed in the USA Today, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation announced they would no longer be giving the award to teams with, quote, racist mascots. and they called out the chiefs in specific. The conversation begins with Rhonda Livaldo. She teaches at Haskell in Lawrence, and she hosts a show on KKFI called Native Spirit. Hi, Rhonda.
Hello.
So I'll explain the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's critique of the chief's name in a minute, but before we get into that, what can you tell us about the history of the name, where it comes from?
Okay, well, so it comes from a previous mayor of Kansas City, Roe Bartle, and he was part of the Boy Scouts and started a group called Mikasay, and they are kind of like an offshoot of the Boy Scouts. They're not necessarily supported by the Boy Scouts, but I was looking at their website yesterday, and they do have the Boy Scout logo still on there, so...
This is in Missouri,
right? This is in Missouri.
And it still goes on.
It still goes
on.
All of this. And they're basically non-natives who dress up as natives. They have their own, I guess you could say, names for each other, like chief, medicine man, elder, you know, brazeman. And so they have these different names for different groups of people, and so they teach young boys how to be Indian. And so
you're doing air quotes.
Yeah, air quotes. But it's really cultural appropriation of Native culture. And what they're doing is actually they've branched out on social media with Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, and they're basically appropriating our culture and doing these dances to young kids in schools and performances.
Are they like, I don't know how to put, are they real dances? Is it sort of like, of course it's a real dance, people are doing it, but are these actual, are they dances that exist in Native culture?
Yes, they are powwow dances. And so they're appropriating Native culture and, you know, doing these performances. And people don't know if they're Native American or not. I think pretty sure they probably think they are Native American, but they aren't. And so it's like, you know, we have at Haskell, we have groups of students who go out and they do performances at schools at different functions, and they use the money that they make to go back into their activities or you know, buy stuff for their clubs or their organizations. And so it's kind of taken away from that. You know, we have students who can do that, but you have non-natives that are appropriating this culture. And so Roe Bartle started this group, and this is kind of where the chief's names came from. He wasn't an actual chief, and the story goes that...
But he had the nickname chief,
yeah,
like in this Boy Scout-esque group.
Yes. And the story goes that he was adopted by a tribe. But being adopted does not make you Native American, you know.
So it's an I've heard this story that it comes, that the chief's name comes from Bartle's nickname, the chief. But what I didn't know is where the nickname came from. Also, I mean, there are other competing stories about the history of the name. This is something that you feel pretty like confident about.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And Mikasay, again, is still thriving out there. They're on YouTube. I believe they have a YouTube channel called, it's kind of going off of the, I guess, the Indian speak that they have. It's called Make Talk Now. And so it's, again, perpetuating these stereotypes. So this is how we talk.
Yeah. I mean, I can see the frustration and just like disbelief in your face as you explain this. How do you feel? Can you explain the feeling that you have when you encounter this kind of information in a little more detail?
Well, so I teach media at Haskell, and one of my classes that I teach is mass communications. And so one of the things we do is I have the students look at all the media that influences and is influential with Native Americans in Hollywood, the stereotypes of Native Americans. And I have them actually do, you know, a research paper of like of what they see. And so one of the things that I noticed is that they're more aware of how they've been lumped into looking like what people think we should look like, wearing a headdress, having long hair, being brown skin. But if you look at our student body at Haskell, it's very diversified. And those kids that don't look Native, they feel upset about it because people will ask them, well, you don't look Indian. well, what's an Indian supposed to look like? Well, we're seeing this is what we're, you know, these cultural appropriators say we should be wearing headdresses or, you know, whatever they're wearing or talking like how they're trying to talk. That's not who we are.
Well, how do you feel about living in a city where the football team is called the Chiefs, the stadium is called Arrowhead?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's annoying. And I don't mind. I think, you know, whatever, they're doing great. But as a Native American that has to deal with the tomahawk chop, and it's not even just at the game, because I've never been, well, I've been to the games outside trying to educate people about them, but I've never been inside a game. But if you go to any concert here in Kansas City, people start to do that chant.
Yeah, like if it's a Sunday.
Yeah, and it's like, can't I escape from having to deal with that chant? And it's really
annoying.
What bothers
you about the chant?
I just wish I didn't have to listen to it. And it's, again, it's one of these things, misnomers of what we do, of the sounds we make. And that's not what we do.
It seems to me that a lot of Kansas Cityans do give the Chiefs a pass on this. People of a lot of different races, people all over the political spectrum. Is that your sense too?
Yeah, I believe. And they think it's not as bad as Washington, but it still is, because you're allowing your fans to be cultural appropriators of our culture and, you know, making fun of it. I've been outside the stadium again. I was out there last year when they played Washington, and you have fans coming by and cussing you out and basically making you feel like we're not human beings. And that's probably the biggest problem.
Can you tell me what it is you say to fans outside the stadium? And
well, what I do is when they're playing Washington, I have a sign and basically showing the discrepancies of who they represent. So Washington is supposedly named after a Native American player named Lone Star Dietz, who was not Native American. And so kind of just explaining that on this board and then explaining who Washington or who Kansas City is named after, and Roe Bartle, and he's not Native American.
So I do want to turn to someone else here. But before I do, here's the deal with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. They used to see team names like ours as essentially harmless to their communities. But then the president and CEO of the foundation, a physician who lives in New Jersey, was called out for giving health awards to teams like the Chiefs and the Redskins. So he looked into it, and he actually came to agree with his critics. He wrote a really heartfelt op-ed in the USA Today. It was essentially a public statement about the deep psychological consequences of perpetuating American Indian stereotypes, whether people deem those stereotypes offensive or not. And he called the foundation's former policy of granting big awards to teams like the Chiefs a mistake. For more on that, let's turn to researcher Michael Friedman. Good morning.
Good morning.
You are a clinical psychologist, and your research is on the Redskins. What did you research exactly?
What I did was a review of the literature. And, you know, first, let me just say to Ron, I'm sorry that you had that experience and continue to have that experience. My research, both in terms of the studies and in terms of the people I've spoken with, reveal that that's unfortunately far too common. But what I did with this particular literature review was look at what is the evidence that American Indian sports teams' names and logos actually cause harm, particularly to American Indian children. And there were basically three forms of evidence. One was that there were several studies that show that if you put a range of American Indian sports teams' names or logos in front of American Indian kids, their self-esteem gets worse, their faith in their community gets worse, their belief that they can achieve gets worse, and their mood gets worse in the form of depression and anxiety. So those were experimental studies that show, regardless of whether or not someone considered a particular team name or logo offensive, psychological harm was done to children. The second set of data showed, well, what happens among people who are not American Indian? And what this shows is that far from the sense that this is something that is an honor or something that's good, people tend to process implicitly, in terms of their information processing, American Indian sports teams' names and logos with negative information. So what happens is that
people don't... Wait, can you explain that a little bit? Like, what kind of negative information?
Well, so the way that information processing tasks go is they see whether or not the speed with which you associate certain terms, like in this case chiefs, with more negative as opposed to positive words. And that's seen as a measure of what some people refer to as a schema, which is an underlying way of understanding the associations that people have. It's considered to be outside of conscious thought and more in terms of fast information processing.
Huh.
And
but, so are there specific negative words that people associate with a word like chief?
The studies don't necessarily look at specific negative words. They look at negative words in general, and they looked at a range of different American Indian mascots, so chief, the Washington team, Seminoles, etc. And all the studies that were done show the same thing, which is that people tend to associate these American Indian sports team names and logos with negative information. And so that was a second piece of data, which is saying that, look, when American Indian kids see these things, they feel bad. People who are not American Indian feel more negatively about the terms. And then there was a third group of information, third group of studies, which looked at discrimination in general as measured by racial slurs, harassment, bullying, all the things that, unfortunately, Rhonda was talking about happen on a regular basis surrounding these sports teams' names. And what they found was that over time, these discrimination predicts aggression, hostility, increased substance abuse. And so what we have here is we have three different types of data all pointing to the same conclusion, is that American Indian sports teams' names and logos, such as the Chiefs, unfortunately does harm to American Indian kids.
When I was researching for this show, I read an article that was not about professional sports teams' names, but like high school team names and things that really go under our radar. And the number of team names throughout this country at just like every level that reference Native Americans is huge. And I'm curious, like, what that's about and just your sense of the scope of this issue.
Well, I think what it's about is it's part of a bigger picture, which is why this issue is so important. This American Indians are the only group of people in this country or anywhere else for that matter who are forced to tolerate racist team names and logos in such a widespread way. Just like you said, it's on the high school level, it's on the college level, it's on the professional level. It is pervasive in our society. And this is part of a bigger picture of the disparities that American Indians face in our culture. American Indians have the poorest access to education, poorest access to health, poorest access to housing. There is a lot that's being discussed now about opportunities with voting rights. And particularly germane to this conversation, American Indian kids have among the highest level of psychological distress and oftentimes the highest rates of suicidality in the country. And so what you're seeing is that this practice is not an isolated event or an isolated for one team or in one situation. This is part of a bigger picture of disparities that is facing American Indians in this country, which is why when I discuss this, I discuss this not as, you know, something that is an issue of political correctness, but one of public health. Anything that is happening that is causing more stress to American Indian kids who are already under a great deal of stress and experience psychological symptoms and ultimately leading to things like substance abuse and suicide has to be something that we can take seriously, because we can actually change this and we can actually make a difference potentially.
In the op-ed I mentioned, the head of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation referenced a survey by the Washington Post showing that 90% of the Native Americans they polled were not offended by the Redskins name. And he said that he mentioned that to one of his critics, the head of the National Congress of American Indians, and she told him, and I quote, "Native American resilience does not give the team a pass." What are your thoughts here?
Well, I think that the first thing that I would say is that I've never, in my experience as a clinical psychologist, heard of determining things having to do with public health based on unscientific polls. This is just not the way that things are done. The second thing is that there are other polls that have been conducted in which people were asked to show tribal identity that shows that the overwhelming majority actually did find the Washington team name offensive. So I feel like that when people are looking at polls, they tend to be a little bit selective at which ones they look at. But the other thing that's also important is that the studies that were done that I described, where American Indian kids were looking at the sports teams' names and logos, in part of the study, they asked whether or not this was something that, you know, bothered them or they found to be upsetting, and they said no. Because the problem is that these negative effects happen regardless of whether or not somebody is, quote-unquote, offended.
There might stereotyping... also be some pressure to be okay with things.
Well, I think it's very much like what Rhonda described. I think that, you know, not only, you know, in the way that I've always described it is that think about in any other context, if you are doing something like dressing up as someone who's not of your culture or wearing war paint or beating drums or doing that tomahawk chop in a business or in school and somebody asks you to stop and you don't stop, that's ultimately considered harassment or bullying. And we have very strict standards on that. But what we are seeing on a national level is the National Congress of the American Indian, which is the largest, most representative group of tribes in the world, is directly and repeatedly asking the NFL, the Washington team, Kansas City team, to stop doing this. And they don't. So the question that we have is what is that modeling for kids? Is that giving people the green light to say, hey, all of the cultural appropriation that we see is okay because, hey, it's okay for the adults. Why is it not okay for the kids? Is the bullying okay? And again, I go back to Rhonda, you know, to Rhonda's description, is that that's just unfortunately every time I go to a conference or I you know, talk about this issue, I'm always hoping that maybe it's not as bad as I think. You know, maybe it is just, you know, political correctness, and maybe it is just, you know, the other things that I've been accused of or other people have been accused of have talked to this issue. But no, we keep hearing stories of how this concept of, you know, oh, it's okay, you know, there was a poll that says it was okay, so we can keep doing it. To me, that's just teaching people how to bully and how to harass.
Rhonda Lavaldo, jump back in here.
Yeah, well, so that poll, the specific numbers of that, 504 self-identified Native Americans, and I bring this up in my class as well. As Native people, whenever we identify ourselves as Native American, oh, what tribe are you? And in that poll, 50% of them said they could not even name any tribal nation of where they're from. They couldn't even name what tribe they were. So there had to be something wrong with that. And the other part is, how do you self-identify? How do you determine those people are really Native American over a phone? You know, again, for us, every student who goes to Haskell is Native American. They're a member of a federally recognized tribe. And there's no question of, oh, I don't believe you're not Native American, because they're there. They had to prove it to be there. So in that poll, how are you going to prove you're Native American?
How do you recommend that football fans in Kansas City who love their team make sense of this for themselves? Is there a way to reconcile the challenges of the Chiefs' name with the love of the team and the excitement people are feeling over how well they're playing?
You know, I have no problems with, you know, the football team. It's just that the fans that go overboard with the cultural appropriation, wearing headdresses, wearing face paint, doing the tomahawk chop, those are really disrespectful to our Native people and our Native nations.
Rhonda Lavaldo is a media and communications professor at Haskell. She hosts a show called Native Spirit on KKFI. We talked to her last December along with Michael Friedman from the University of Washington. He's a clinical psychologist. That's a wrap for today. We spoke earlier with Simon Tam, founder of a band called The Slants and author of Slanted, How an Asian American Troublemaker Took on the Supreme Court. He's speaking at a leadership conference in Kansas City this week. Anything you missed will be available at kcur.org/centralstandard by the end of the day. Tomorrow, supporting young women with bras that fit. We'll talk to a local mom who set out to make sure that all the kids in our community are outfitted for the school year. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell and Ann Knigendorf. The conversation about the Chief's name was originally produced by Coy Duggar in December. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Stay tuned.